Artist Lisa Rehane is perhaps best known for her extraordinary video installation called In Pursuit of Venus Infected, which was New Zealand's entry in the 2017 Venice Biennale. Lisa Rehane is the Aotearoa New Zealand Festival of the Arts 2022 Artist in Focus. So, in addition to In Pursuit of Venus showing at Te Papa already, she is presenting, come February, a new series of installations along Wellington's waterfront, collectively called Kura Moana. Lisa Rehane currently stuck, I imagine, somewhere in New Zealand, joins me now. Kia ora.
Ah, ngā mihi, Kim.
So you would have been down here were it not for COVID, I imagine.
I would have been freezing myself off. We opened In Pursuit of Venus at Te Papa the other morning with a blessing, and I had to beam in from Auckland, from Tāmaki.
Let's talk about that. I went to see it again the other day, and I can't remember what's different from the first time I saw it, which would have been in Auckland. It's been through a number of changes. Can you tell me about those?
Certainly. Once we'd presented In Pursuit of Venus Infected in Auckland, that was 2015, and I pitched it for the Venice Biennale, and we got Venice, which is like the Olympics of the art world. It gave me the opportunity to develop a couple more aspects that I hadn't been able to undertake, because the project was largely driven by myself, self-funded, self-directed. But what happened is I've had a long relationship with many galleries in Australia, and one of them, Campbelltown Art Centre, came back to me and offered to help me work with Aboriginal community so I could include some scenes. I was really keen to have those aspects in it to kind of, I think from my time working in Australia and knowing the sentiments of the original wallpaper and some of the ideas that came about post-colonialism, was to really foreground and have Aboriginal actors and performances in the work. So that's by and large what was added in.
I saw an Inuit in the ocean fishing from a canoe. Is that an add-in as well?
That was actually already there.
Was it?
But the more you watch this,
the more you see. I mean, it's something. I last for I don't know how long it lasts for 60 minutes maybe, or is
yes,
it less than
64
that?
64 minutes. It's kind of two loops of 32 minutes with one swap out of one scene, which is a kind of a gender. You have to look. It's for the train spotters, where I repeat one of the scenes, and in one there's Captain Cook played by a male actor, and in another Captain Cook is played by a female.
Why?
So there's a kind of switch. Well, I met this lovely woman, Julia Waite, and she told me that when she was growing up, her nickname was Cook, and she just turned her face to profile, and I looked at her and she had the same look as Captain Cook. And I thought it was a great opportunity to play with this idea of gender, having read some of the accounts around Captain Cook and when he arrived in various different parts around the Pacific. Because he wore breeches, they couldn't see whether he was a male or a female, because to those early ancestors and these people arriving in these kind of marvelous ships, almost like spaceships, he was like a out of this world. I'd say not a god necessarily, but different. And so people didn't know if Cook was a male or a female. So I wanted to play on that notion too. I mean, In Pursuit of Venus, or POV, is a term you use in the filmmaking world as in point of view. So I was trying to swing around and play with these points of view that they shift according to what side of the, whether you're a landed person or you come from the ocean, if you're a traveller or if you're Indigenous, we see the same things differently. And I think that for me, I wanted to make that particular work quite complicated and quite nuanced. So there's always reason to return to it. And every time you go back, you'll see something else, which is probably the same experience that you're just speaking about.
Yes,
now.
Yes, exactly. Did you know that double entendre when you called it Pursuit of Venus, POV?
Yes, I did. I've been around the film industry and the art world for a long time, and growing up in the 1980s, well, I was born in the 60s, but I think in the 1980s and into the 1990s was such a flourishing time for Aotearoa New Zealand, not even thought of as Aotearoa then, but I was meeting a lot of people like Don Selwyn, Mera Tamita, Barry Barclay, all those amazing Māori filmmakers who were advocating for airtime and broadcast radio. And that was always the discussion at that time, was who's holding the camera, what kind of stories are you tell, which perspective are they being told from. So that POV, that point of view, was very, very important, and that notion of representation. And that's probably something that you see across all of my artwork. And as much as there's the cultural aspect, it's the gender aspects as well.
We will talk more of this. Let us have a check. It's a quick one. It's Elvis Presley, Crawfish. Why have you chosen this?
I chose this from my mum, who I know is listening in. She was always she collected music when I was young, and this was one of the first albums we had in our house. And I mean, Elvis Presley was just such an icon, so beautiful and handsome, and this kind of, in some ways, a very tragic figure in the end. I mean, he had a marvelous life. But I think what I like about him was he sort of pushed against the edges of things, and being a Native American man, which probably influenced the way that he presented himself in the world too.
Crawfish, crawfish. I went to the bayou just last night. There was no moon, but the stars were bright. Put a big long hook on a big long pole, and I pulled Mr. Crawfish out of his hole. Size, stripped and cleaned before your eyes. Sweet meat, look fresh and ready to cook. Crawfish,
crawfish.
Now take Mr. Crawfish in your hand. He's gonna look good in your frying pan. If you fry him crisp, or you boil him right, he'll be sweeter than sugar with every bite. Crawfish,
crawfish.
See, I got him, see the size, stripped and cleaned before your eyes. Sweet meat, look fresh and ready to cook. Crawfish,
crawfish.
It's Elvis Presley with Crawfish. That other voice was Kitty White, and it was one of the picks of Lisa Rehana. I don't think I'd ever thought of Elvis Presley being Native American, Lisa.
Oh, yes, and I do love the combination of, I mean, that's from the Kid Creole soundtrack, and him singing with a black woman. I mean, yeah, growing up, even thinking about I Love Lucy, you know, these yes. images that really influenced me, you know, the first intercultural marriage shown on television, on American television. So these kind of influences filter down through you. But also listening to that song, it's such a groovy song, and it's about food. Hey, close to my heart.
What's not to love? Where does your mother hail from?
She's English and Welsh and Jewish. So I would be quite a bitzer, I think. And my mum ended up migrating from London after the war and ended up in Wellington. So they came across to New Zealand. I never got to meet my Welsh grandfather. He'd passed before I was born. But the influence of, you know, there was a real push in the 80s and 90s for biculturalism, closer economic ties between Australia and New Zealand. All these kind of things were swirling around. But when I think about me, I was sort of feeling very much in the middle, in the sense that I'm Ngāpuhi Nui Tonu, Ngāpuhi proud. So Māori culture has very much influenced me because I'm a sort of first generation urban artist. But then having eventually getting to travel overseas and going to England and thinking about these kind of colonial, post-colonial atrocities that had happened across the world and in Aotearoa, and then walking down the streets of London and thinking, oh my goodness, nobody here even understands where I come from. It's really hard to pin these kind of histories on individuals in some ways. You know, people go on about their lives. People are surviving. They're doing what they can do. So, yes, my mum and her sister and their small family unit of four migrated to New Zealand, paid their way on the £10 passage. And so that's my kind of ancestry, a very mixed ancestry, which plays out in a lot of the works that I do.
Yeah, and your works are multi-layered and with a lot of allusions, and In Pursuit of Venus is classic. Infected in brackets after it. Why? Beyond the kind of obvious. It's got a new resonance right now, of course.
Yes, it really does. I was thinking about this idea of infected. Well, the title, In Pursuit of Venus, like I wanted to have this allusion to love, but a lot of the works that I make, I have tried to, in the title, embody some kind of aroha and love. And that sort of relates to Captain Cook and his being tasked to record the transit of Venus. But infected, you know, it was a great scientific mission, and it was an international mission at that time. Once you know something, you can't unknow it. Captain Cook was such a good cartographer. He laid down the Google map of the time, which meant that colonization was inevitable. It was in process anyway, but it really sped everything up and changed our histories and our lives forever. And perhaps if it hadn't been the English, it would have been the French, could have been the Spanish, could have been the Germans. You know, it was in process that greed and thirst for resources, which continues all the way around the world. So that infected also relates to the pathogens that were arriving on the boats as a result of travel. And it really does have, I'm very aware of the resonance that it's having for our times right now.
The wallpaper you mentioned, people who aren't quite familiar with the evolution of In Pursuit of Venus might not be aware of what you were talking about. You were talking about wallpaper, exotic wallpaper created by Joseph Dufour. And this was the inspiration for In Pursuit of Venus, and indeed was part of certainly the Venice Biennale exhibition. Where is that original wallpaper now?
Les Sauvages de la Mer Pacifique is the name of the wallpaper. It's a French scenic wallpaper, a panoramic wallpaper. It was made for stately homes. Very interesting. When you look at the history of that wallpaper, it has a lot to do with travel. It was only possible because of Montgolfier, who was a paper manufacturer. He also made some of the first hot air balloons. So that idea of looking and seeing the world differently. He created long strips of wallpaper. So then people who had the money but couldn't afford to have tapestries in their homes started to buy into wallpaper. So there's a full set that's owned at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney. The first one I ever saw was at the Australian National Gallery in Canberra. But it's distributed right throughout the world. there's probably maybe a dozen complete sets. There's not so many. There's examples of them. A couple of years back, we showed In Pursuit of Venus at Hawaii Museum, and they have a complete set. It's also been shown in California. They have a set at the De Young Museum. So it's really interesting. This work, this wallpaper was made in the 1800s, and my work's made 200 years later. But they really both, at their time, they were kind of technical marvels. And in some ways, by making this work and then presenting it around the world, it seems to function and capture people's imagination in the same way it did as a wallpaper 200 years before people were able to travel so easily. It was more that kind of armchair travellers. So while we're sort of, particularly in New Zealand, we're not travelling quite so much, it's really interesting to see how this video work is playing out. It's been shown so many places around the world. I've taken it to Germany and Estonia, and we've been talking to Russia and all sorts of places.
Do people respond to it quite differently in various places?
It's interesting. I think what people respond to is there's lots of ins for the audience. You know, if you like performance or song, if you like technology, if you don't like video art, it still looks like a painting. There's the soundtrack is incredibly evocative. So there's lots of different things that people respond to within the work itself, but it's also about the way that it's presented by, whether it's in the contemporary gallery or shown in, alongside customary works from the Pacific. I mean, there are works, our artworks and taonga are spread right across the world, and it has given other collection museums and their collections opportunities to bring them out and show them alongside. And it gives people a better sense of what it's like down here in our part of the world. And I think it allows people to really think about what that moment was like, rather than reading it from a book, seeing people enacting. I mean, I've tried to take real journal accounts, and I've written a few of my own. I mean, it's an artwork, not a historic piece, but it starts to indicate what it might have felt like to see people for the first time and to have those misunderstandings.
You mentioned Australia and the inclusion of Aboriginal figures in The Pursuit of Venus, and your next track is Yodu Yindi Treaty. This was the first song by a predominantly Aboriginal band to hit the charts in Australia in 1991. What are you thinking about it?
Well, when I was first left art school, I got a residency and I went and stayed in Australia for, well, basically I had a residency for 3 months, but I managed to swing it for 12, which was fantastic because I think it's really nice to go to a place and not just be a traveller, but to sort of really understand all the, what a whole year feels like, a much broader period of time. When I was there, it was 1988, and that was the year of the bicentenary, and there was a lot of advocating by Aboriginal activists, and they're really pushing for treaty and for recognition. I mean, the racism that I saw with my own eyes when I went to Australia really shocked me, and the residency that I had was an invitation for a Maori artist to come and meet Aboriginal communities and artists and people and try and set up some sense of understanding. I've taken that really serious, that concept, and it actually, it stayed with me. But I think Yotu Yindi were like a really famous band at the time the song came out, and I love this combination of English and them singing in language, and it's just kind of quite a groovy song, so let's have a listen.
Words are easy, words are cheap. lies deeper than our priceless land. But promises can disappear, just like writing in the sand. Treaty, yeah, treaty now. Treaty, yeah, treaty now. Up. This land was never bought and sold. The planting of the Union Jack never changed our law at all. Now two rivers run their course, separated for so long. I'm dreaming of a brighter day when the waters will be.
Yodu Yindi with a song called Treaty, one of the picks of artist Lisa Rehana, who was the Aotearoa New Zealand Festival of the Arts 2022 Artist in Focus. It's true, you talked about going to Australia in 1988, Lisa, and I can remember going to Australia in the 70s, and it seems such a brutally racist place. And whether they were just more outspoken about it, and we were more secretive about our racism. But at the time, it was a shock to the system, right?
It really was, yeah. When I would be with some of my... I remember going out dancing one night with my Aboriginal girlfriends, and a group of quite big Australian white women just surrounding us and then swearing at us, and I had never experienced that before. And yes, exactly what you said, maybe they're most likely to say it out loud. Didn't mean that we didn't have racism in Aotearoa as well, but it really stayed with me how awful, you know, it's quite a tough land, and I think it creates quite tough cultures in Australia. But you know, when I've gone and done talks here, and I've spoken public and said I love Australia and I hate it, and everyone goes takes a big gasp. But I think it's those kind of aspects that I'm talking about.
Interestingly, the Aboriginal culture is not a tough culture.
It's beautiful. I mean, I'm really lucky at present time. Not only have I been working on Kura Moana, I'm working towards a major new, almost like the scale of In Pursuit of Venus. I'm making a new video work for a gallery that opens at the end of next year called the Sydney Modern. And it's given me the opportunity to collaborate with a lot of other Australian creatives. So it's really annoying being stuck this year. I've been meant to have flown over there a couple of times, but we're having to organise things remotely at present. But they're so beautiful, and I've always thought about this Maori notion of tuakanatena, the older person teaching the younger. And I always think it's such an old culture right next door to us, and we're the youngest nation on earth. So there's just so much that we can learn from each other if you allow, you know, if you're open and allow these opportunities to spring forth.
You mentioned Kura Moana, which is your series of installations around the Wellington waterfront for the Arts Festival. What does Kura Moana mean?
It's about the knowledge. Kura, knowledge of the ocean. So that was a gifted name from Te Ate Awa, working with Tawhiri, the office that runs the Aotearoa New Zealand Arts Festival. And for me, hailing from Ngāpuhi as my iwi, I wanted to find some way to make a connection to Pōneke, to Wellington. And Kupe, of course, looms large in your area. He crossed the Cook Strait and has named so many different land sites at the top of the South Island and around Wellington, and indeed in Hokianga, where he first came to in up north. So I thought Kupe was my connector. And so Kupe, I've been working with him as a, you know, this idea of travellers and you know, just really strong people who are brave enough to cross the oceans into unknown territories, and these kind of fearless travellers. But also it gave me an opportunity to really think about his wife, Hinita Aparangi, who named Aotearoa, the North Island Aotearoa, which is the name that stuck, that we now associate with all of New Zealand. So I wanted to look at him, think about him as a great ancestral figure, about the other people that were on the boat, and then also the whiki, the octopus that he chased across the ocean. And when I was imagining him, sort of these wonderful sort of creation stories that are passed down, and thinking, oh, it must have been a female octopus, and then realising that, yes, indeed it was, these kind of men chasing the kind of female, this watery, strong entity, and why he sort of ended up here in Aotearoa. So if there's a whole series of...
Yeah, yeah, I just wondered, what do you think about calling the whole of the country Aotearoa, as is the notion at the moment, given that Hinete Aparangi just applied Aotearoa to the North Island?
Oh, I think it opens up further discussions. And it's really interesting. Even a couple of years ago, I was trying to remember the name Mount Egmont. You know, like, we've just got used to, when you change a name, yes, it sort of seems like such a big thing initially, but actually it's not in the end, and we can learn language, and they just sort of tend to open up more doors. I don't think you have to lose anything. I think you gain more. One of the things I always wished when I was younger, I always wanted to learn Te Reo Māori, and it was very, very difficult in our education system as I was growing up. And it was really important to me because my father left his tribal homelands and came to Auckland for work. So I was like first generation urban. And it particularly struck me when I go to other places in the world, in Europe, you know, people would have three or four languages. They could just describe things in many different ways, and they actually strike upon one word that really better encapsulated what they were trying to say. You know, sometimes even now there's Maori words that when I'm talking to, when I'm doing presentations overseas, I actually struggle to find, you know, the English equivalent, because, you know, there's a sense about it. And I think Aotearoa, I think it's beautiful. I think it's a beautiful word, and I'm very pleased, actually. One of the works that I'm doing for Kura Moana is to bring focus to the William Trithewey statue, which is down the bottom of town. And there's the figures of Kupe, his wife, and the tohunga. And I asked for permission from Ngāti Huata, who wrote a beautiful waiata called Aotearoa, and we're just going to play it round that statue just to bring focus back to it again, and to hear a woman's voice with that sort of gorgeous sort of Art Deco statuary. And it feels really amazing that the Arts Festival has rebranded itself this year with Aotearoa New Zealand Arts Festival. I've been using Aotearoa / New Zealand for many, many years as an artist because I think it brings more resonance and a better context to the works that I'm presenting when I'm travelling the world.
Can you imagine so that it will eventually be only Aotearoa without the New Zealand?
Perhaps. I mean, it's funny because Zealand, you know, is to do with Holland. And I don't know that many people wouldn't necessarily make that connection. You know, I've looked at Abel Tasman when I've been thinking about In Pursuit of Venus, him citing land, and I've been to Holland a number of times and presented the work there. But it's not the first thing that pops into people's heads. So I think it's a good locator. When you're travelling around the world, you want to actually open up opportunities. It's like a handshake. So I think Aotearoa / New Zealand, I'm really happy. I think more is more. You know, people say less is more, but more is more. I can count.
Talking about gorgeous songs and voices, your next track is Whirimako Black with Hei Taonga. And this was... This is connected with a piece by you in the Pātika Gallery as part of the festival, yes?
Yes, it's a beautiful work. I initially made it for Te Papa Tongarewa, where I was invited to be an artist and do a series. I made a series of artworks to the entrance to Arahine, which is the entrance up to the marae in Te Papa. And I made this beautiful, I really have always adored the song. It's so sweet and so beautiful, and it's very poignant. Whirimako wrote the song for members of the Māori Battalion, recognising those who have passed. So for me, it's that kind of connector between the world of the living and our ancestors. To me, it's like a portal. So this song, at the time I filmed it, so she's singing in slow motion. And there were so many noises in the museum that I decided to put it inside a case and have her singing it in this very gentle way. And it was interesting. My friend John Tootle talked about putting it inside a case as a silent film, really talked about how our language had been taken. But at the time I was thinking next beside her, there was the sound of the birds and the gallery next door. So I liked that there was this combination of the human world and other aspects of the world that we live in.
Heroi mata au
Whirimako Black, Hei Taonga. What a gorgeous voice she has, right?
Isn't it beautiful? It's just, every time I hear the song, it brings tears to my eyes. And, you know, it's a beautiful song just to recognise all those people who have passed at any time and at all times.
It's from her album called Shrouded in the Mist, Hine Puko Hurangi. Can you tell me a little more about the new video you're making for Sydney Morton?
Yeah, sure. It's called Ground Loop, and I've been thinking about coupe, of course, but I've been doing so many historic works that I wanted to pitch something into the future. And initially, when I first wrote the concept, it was a bit more dystopian. I sort of pitched this idea that, you know, Whakaari Island had blown up and people were exiting Aotearoa and going to Australia. I was trying to think of a reason, you know, I was thinking about these histories. When Māori came to New Zealand, why didn't they just keep going that little bit further and keep going on to Australia, given how close it is? And then in the fullness of time and thinking about this work playing as a public work in a public gallery, you know, it could be up for a couple of years at least, looping away, I thought it was not a good story to keep playing. When you're making work and you're putting it out into the world, it does kind of call up what you imagine. So I decided that this work, Ground Loop, should be much more celebratory and much more positive. So it's a story in the future when maybe it's post-aeroplane travel. We just hop in our waka and just head across the ditch. And there's a kind of free flow of craft. And a sharing of Indigenous knowledge and a much greater recognition and care and aroha for Mother Earth, so that we're looking after her. It is a very utopian idea, but it's something that I feel is almost speaking back to In Pursuit of Venus, thinking about a kind of alternative history that could have happened, perhaps if we hadn't been colonised by the British. Or maybe it's just another point in time. But it's going to be cruised with Māori, Pacific, and First Australian on board. And just the sharing of language being first and foremost, and ceremony being utilised daily and recognised. So it's an interesting project to try and pull off, given that I can't even be
Country
right now.
What did you say it's going to be called?
Ground Loop.
Ground Loop. Good.
Yeah.
I don't know anything more about this, your collaboration with the shoe designer Christian Louboutin in Paris last year.
Yes.
What was that?
He did this incredible exhibition called Christian Louboutin L'Exhibitionniste, and he saw In Pursuit of Venus at the Venice Biennale, just actually a couple of days before it closed, and loved the work, and contacted me and asked me if I would do a biography for him. So I spent a good couple of years just on and off spending some time with him in France, Paris, and also in Egypt and Portugal. And I worked with him and filmed some of these beautiful objects and places and things that had inspired him, to kind of give a more alternative and dreamlike indication of a biography of his history and his life. So it was really fantastic to spend time with him and to be commissioned to do a work for an art museum, but quite different than what you might do in the art world, you know, the fashion world. I mean, I've always loved fashion and costume design. Perhaps we can listen to another track, which is Vogue.
That's what I want to play next, exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think just living in that world is really exciting for me. I mean, one of the things I love about being an artist that's working with moving image is the costume design, everything about, you know, that sits around it, not just, you know, you have to sort of work at every single level. And I think there's so much you can tell, so many stories that come about in terms of the way that we present ourselves in the world.
Have you got any Louboutin? So, have you got any Louboutin shoes?
I do now. Yes, I do.
I bet you do now.
Fabulous pair of sneakers that are actually the best things I ever got. And of course, I got a really ridiculously and slightly uncomfortable pair of shoes that I wore to the opening of his show in Paris last year.
Tell me what they were like.
Well, I like them because they're like 1970s platforms. I chose them. They're like rainbow suede, and they would have looked fabulous in the 70s. Big chunky heel. Christian was quite surprised by my choice, but I used to walk around with like really skinny little heels, but I don't do that so much anymore. I need to kind of stomp around. I've got too many things to do in a day. But it was a very fabulous opening in an incredible Art Deco museum. And I'm very pleased to now say that show is going to open in Monaco next year. So I'm pleased it's travelling because he's a very interesting character. He is a fashion icon, but he's a very lovely, lovely man who's really interested in culture and so smart. Loves architecture. He's an Egyptologist. I mean, he's actually Egyptian. He works with so many. He loves to collaborate with people. He's very open, and there's something really light and bright about the way he is as a person. So I'm not surprised that his atelier has done so well in the world.
Well, speaking of footwear, your next track is Deep in Vogue by Malcolm McLaren and the Bootzilla Orchestra. Tell me about this. Why does this strike you?
Well, it kind of reminds me of my times of being young and youthful and living illegally in buildings around the city. I had a lot of friends. We lived in the city when it was kind of not the thing to do. We would do up warehouses.
Were you squatting?
Well, we weren't squatting as such because we were paying rent. It's just that you weren't supposed to live in the cities. It kind of predates the times that we live in now. But I think because there was just bunches of people sort of undercover living in all sorts of buildings. I mean, it was, for me as an artist, it was a cheap way to sort of live in the city and also have a studio. And it was really fun and sort of, I don't know, kicking against what was supposed to happen and things that we were seeing happening overseas, you know, hearing about people squatting in London or people living in lofts in New York. You know, there was a sort of small select group of people and they became great friends, you know, talking about, you know, becoming involved with Pacific Sisters, for instance. I was meeting those women back then. They were also living in the city. And I think what was also interesting, you know, that kind of gender bending that was happening in the 1980s as well. I think Malcolm McLaren, because of our sort of English history, I mean, I was really interested in punk music, loved that. And then these kind of hybrids, these new modes of music. I mean, all these music I've played today, I think, are like these kind of new blends, hybridized song and musicianship. So but this is really funky. This is such a great song.
You might have to explain what ball culture and voguing was or is.
Well, there was a fabulous documentary made by Jenny Livingston called Paris is Burning, and that's when it really came to my attention, I don't know, back in the 80s. Black men dressing up to sort of pass as women in the street, the LGBTQI groups of people. And so this is like their party time. And it was certainly Pacific Sisters as a group. We would have brothers who were sisters and this whole gender bending. And, you know, it's really shifted a lot to what we're seeing today, these new pronouns. These ideas were just really becoming much more populist at this time from an underground perspective to now, you know, 30 years later. You know, you have the faff swag balls, a lot of Pacific drag queens, lots of friends of mine just kind of pushing these boundaries of what is considered normal or not normal. Let's not call it normal, let's just call it fabulous. Or a word that I heard recently, which I love, is faberational.
This has got to be a special tribute to the houses off Newell. La Beja, an extravaganza, magnifique, Celeron, Omni, Ebony, Dupré. Runway modeling in the freeze frame at the board. That's what they call bogey.
In Vogue, Malcolm McLaren, 1989. It's impossible to listen to that without dancing, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it. It just reminds me of the days when I used to go out dancing a lot more than I do these days.
Well, you might have to wear your comfortable sneakers to do that these days.
I think so.
Are you going to be all going well with the COVID? Will you be able to come to the Festival of the Arts in Wellington come next February?
I think so. I think I'd like to do a shout out and tell everybody go and get vaccinated so that we can do these, you know, gather again, feeling safe with family. I really look forward to this opportunity to see people enjoying the artworks that I've presented. You know, I wanted to make something that was free. You know, they're all outdoors, so they're all safe places for people to travel to. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to when I can come down and be. It's so beautiful, Wellington. Wellington on a beautiful day.
On a Wellington on a good day.
Yeah,
it is. Wellington on a good day, as they say.
It's gorgeous. I mean, it's a lovely harbour. So I'm really looking forward to that time next year when we can all be together.
Would you
have a little dance and dance floor?
Well, do you? It's Wellington or Whanganui, Tara or.
Pōneke.
I wonder which one we would prefer it to be called. Do you know?
Well, it's not for me to say. It's not actually my area. But I think hearing, when you start to invoke those names, what you do get to hear is the other stories behind them. And that's a beautiful aspect of our creation.
Roll them around your mouth and see how it goes.
Exactly.
Very nice to talk to you, Lisa Rehana, who's the Aotearoa New Zealand Festival of the Arts Artist in Focus.